In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about Maine, the state of Maine, that is, and a little bit about its history and its culture and how those things came together to form the characters of the people who live there. And our guest with the program is Colin Woodard. He's a journalist who specializes in global affairs. He's the author of Ocean's End, Travels Through Endangered Seas, and also is a regular contributor to a variety of publications, including the Christian Science Monitor, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Chronicle of Higher Education. He has also reported from more than 40 countries around the world, and he was born and raised in Maine and now makes his home in Portland. And he's the author of a book that's titled The Lobster Coast, the subtitle Rebels, Rusticators, and the Struggle for a Forgotten Frontier. It's published by the Viking Press. So if you'd like to join in the conversation at some point, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILO. Mr. Woodard, hello.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
Well, I thank very much for giving us some of your time. Part of the appeal, I guess, for me and having a conversation about Maine, other than the fact that I wish I was there, is that it is one of those, in all place in the country, that is so different from the prairie here where we live. It's hard to imagine a place that's going to be much more different, although I guess you could say that about the mountains, which we don't have, and the desert, which we don't have. But I guess I'm kind of fond of that rocky seacoast that you have out there.
That makes two of us.
So tell me about growing up in Maine. Where did you grow up, and what was it like?
Well, I grew up in a small town, actually in the interior of the state, in the foothills. It sort of border on New Hampshire and the province of Quebec. And it was a town of about 1,000 people, and actually lived a few miles outside of it. But I think the thing that's most unusual about that, unlike a lot of rural places, perhaps in the Midwest, is that Maine was settled so very early, in the early 1600s, and became a backwater about 150 years ago because of changes in technology and the national economy. And as a result, in many, many places in Maine, the sort of families that first came and settled the towns in, as early as, the 1620s or 1730s or 1760s, oftentimes the same families are still there. And even living on the same land that, that the king gave to them, when they first arrived to be the initial colonists of the area. And that sort of led to these sort of ties between families and place that, are sort of unusual in the United States because of their duration and sort of intensity. It's almost like sort of a European nationhood. Yeah. And that's something I noticed very much growing up in the small towns that I grew up in, because my maternal grandparents and my father came to Maine as young adults, and while I was born there, I didn't have the same multi-generational ties that many of my classmates had, and the sort of, the hills are named after the people around you and that kind of thing. And that's becoming less and less common in the United States today as people are moving faster and it's becoming more transient nation in many parts, especially in the East Coast where we are.
Yeah, I like some of the discussion in the book about people whose roots go back in Maine a long, long time, and about how suspicious they are of newcomers, and about how even if you were born there or if you come there to live, it takes a long time before you become accepted as a native. I like the saying that you quote in the book about the kitten, but if the cat has her kittens in the oven, it doesn't make them biscuits. I like that a lot.
Exactly. I mean, just because you can't just become a Mainer by showing up and, getting your driver's license, as you can in at least much of the East Coast. I mean, even somebody like myself who is born and raised here, I'm not quite a true native, as we say, because I don't have those multi-generational ties. I'm somewhere in between. And this is a place where those kind of ties still matter. A lot of the reason for that has to do with its peculiar history. I mean, Mainers are perhaps a little wary of outsiders because outsiders have been trying to sort of take over the state for a very long time. It was actually a colony of a colony in the colonial period. It was taken over, and I hostile annexation by Massachusetts back in the 1650s. And, you know, it sort of ruled in an exploitative fashion for all the way up until 1820.
From Boston.
Left scars on the state today.
Yeah. It's interesting. Now, I guess I would think that probably the big industry in Maine would be tourism. People coming there for a vacation, or if you're lucky enough, you can come there and spend the summertime. But when you go back early in the history of Maine, it really wasn't, in a sense, an industrial state. It was very big in producing timber. It was important for maritime kind of supplies. But one of the things I thought was really fascinating was that for a long time, Maine was a big exporter of ice.
Yeah.
Before there was modern refrigeration, and that over time, as technologies changed, all those industries became obsolete. And so there was a boom, and then there was a bust. And then it's after that that we move into this period where people started thinking about it just as a place to go for the scenery.
Yeah. After 1820, when Maine became independent from Massachusetts again, there's this brief period that was sort of an economic golden age that lasted a few decades. You know, that's the one time in Maine, if you want to remember the good old days. Those were the good old days, because the state was sort of central to the commerce of the nation. It had ice, like you mentioned, and there was a craze for ice, particularly in the southern states. And Maine has all of these rivers and a very cold climate and was relatively clean, so it was supplying ice, but also granite. Much of our coast is basically giant, you know, islands made of granite, and everyone was building all the buildings and paving the streets with granite, and salt cod was still the important food of the poor, and sailing ships, which were mostly built and owned in Maine, were sort of central to the commerce of the nation. But then after the Civil War, simultaneously, all of these industries collapsed overnight because, as you say, somebody invented artificial refrigeration, somebody invented concrete, people invented steel-hulled steamships, and people in the city suddenly discovered, gosh, they prefer fresh fish, strangely enough, to salted fish. Mm. And Maine was just a little bit too far away from Boston and New York and the other major cities to get the fish there while it was still fresh. And then the nation was shifting from sailing vessels to east-west railroads headed out your way. And suddenly, you know, we have very poor soils here and a very short growing season, and all of a sudden you were in direct competition with Ohio and Indiana and Illinois, where you actually have a topsoil to work with. And it led to a economic collapse so profound that parts of the state have still yet to recover from it. It's a 150-year-long depression. And even, you know, wealthier parts of the coast, it only came out of it in the past 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
But it's at that moment in the late 19th century when Maine had this economic collapse that outsiders first discovered the state. It was the very wealthy people were sort of the only people with leisure time at the time in the late 19th century. And they came to Maine and saw this, what they thought was sort of looking back in New England's golden age. They felt like they'd found paradise, because they were coming from, you know, New York and Boston and cities that had just industrialized. And it was the dirty, nasty, you know, 19th century industrialization with soot, and, you know, no one had sewers yet, and no one was cleaning up after the horses in the street, and noisy, and there were all these immigrants coming in, and, you know, who were speaking strange languages and weren't even Protestant, and the sort of wealthy class was sort of appalled that, you know, the cities were changing, were so unlivable. Then they came to Maine, and they felt like, you know, they found this sort of lost golden age of New England, where everyone was still English and, you know, and Protestant and living on the land in these little sort of model Jeffersonian communities. And the sort of dream of Maine, the sort of Maine myth was born, and that they came to somewhere that they felt was sort of cleaner and less corrupt and had somehow dodged the scourges of civilization.
Mm.
Unfortunately, you know, it hadn't just, you know, it wasn't a pre-industrial utopia. The state had just deindustrialized, and people were fleeing the coast, and it was in, you know, a state of profound economic crisis. You can imagine, you know, the sort of disconnect between the local people and the summer cottagers who were coming in, who were sort of seeing the landscape through very different lenses.
Sure. Different socioeconomic background, different class background, different ideas about what they were there for. You could hardly imagine two groups of people that it wouldn't have been more different.
And profound differences, because it was some of the wealthiest people in the country, the people who were first coming to Maine to build these cottages. And they didn't want to see these places that they were going to recharge their batteries change, and they actually used their influence to keep industrialization and automobiles and other technological advances from coming to the towns they lived in, which didn't always help relations any.
Our guest, Colin Woodard, he's a journalist and also was born and raised in Maine. He's the author of the book The Lobster Coast, Rebels, Rusticators, and Struggle for a Forgotten Frontier. That's the subtitle. It's published by Viking. And I guess the people that you were just talking about, those are the Rusticators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what they called themselves. And this sort of early great cottagers, the summer people from the sort of wealthiest strata of East Coast society who came there to spend entire summers in what they called cottages, which were often extremely large mansions on the coast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We have a caller here to talk with in Normal. Let's do that. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, this is about a genealogy type of question. My great-great-grandfather, who fought in the Civil War out of an Illinois regiment, moved to Illinois as a young man from Portland, Maine. And we were stymied in the 1700s. We traced it back, our family, to Portland, Maine in the 1700s, and we're stuck there. My question is, did people come from Europe directly to Portland, Maine ever, or did they go to the other harbors like Boston and New York and eventually move to Portland, Maine?
Statistically, sort of the most likely route that your family might have taken would have been coming to Boston and Connecticut and southern New England first, and spending a generation or two there, and then ending up in Maine. A lot of people did come directly from Europe to Maine in the earliest period, but Maine suffered through a century of Indian wars that sort of stunted settlement. So most of the early families kind of came in the early, mid 1700s, and they were the children and grandchildren of Massachusetts settlers.
Well, that's when I could trace it back to, so I would have looked to that, looked to Massachusetts or New York maybe.
Yeah, if you want to reach back before that, yes, they're probably coming from Connecticut or the eastern parts of Massachusetts.
I see. And one more question, if I might. I heard recently that there's a town, my last name is Brooks, and there's a town called Brooksville, and I was wondering if you'd heard of it and if it was near Portland.
Not too close to Portland. I don't know the origin of Brooks, but it is on the coast here. Yeah, it does exist.
Well, thank you. I'm really enjoying the show.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, and others are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks, but anywhere you might be listening around Illinois, Indiana. In fact, if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you were in the United States, you could use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Now, one of the kind of statistics or things that you talk about in the book that just really amazes me is this the numbers about how there's a certain, from the most northerly point to the most southerly point is a certain distance, but if you take into consideration all the little crags and outcroppings and heads and inlets and everything like that, it's a stunning amount of territory that you cover. You could stretch out the coast of Maine and straighten out all those things, it would be as long as, is it the entire East Coast? Something like that?
Yeah, more than, if you stretched out the rest of the East Coast combined, I think Maine would be a bit longer, even if you stretched out the rest of it. I mean, it's an incredibly ragged and convoluted coast with all of these deep, deep inlets into the sea, one after another, and thousands of islands. And I mean, the amount of waterfront that Maine has is truly spectacular. And that's one of the things that led to it being settled so early. I mean, it's the very first settlements in New England were fishing stations on these islands and peninsulas in Maine, because there was so much deep water frontage and so many anchorages, and it was closer to England than the rest of what became New England. And it became the beginnings of New England, and in a certain sense, America started off the coast.
And also, in addition to being just a perfect place for maritime enterprise, it was, and I suppose all in a lot of that area, the same thing was true. It's not true today, but that there was a staggering amount of fish available.
Oh yeah, I mean the early accounts are just remarkable of the number of fish. I mean the early reconnaissance missions that England was settling out to explore this new world they'd discovered. They were staffed by fishermen from the west country of England largely, and people very familiar with fisheries resources, and they were just amazed. I mean, describing shoals of codfish that, you know, where each individual fish is as big as a man, and, you know, each time they throw a hook over, you know, a second later, they've got one of these enormous fish on the line. As soon as they pull it up, they just drop the hook in again, and it's bitten again. Just staggering resources. I mean, lobsters, you could, you know, just kind of row a paddle boat in shallow water and just gaff them, you know, with a spear. Mm. You'd be gaffing, you know, 5, 6, 10-pound lobsters, as many as you could fill into your boat. And unfortunately, a lot of the fisheries resources have been destroyed in the past 2 to 3 decades through ever larger ships and ever more sophisticated sort of industrial-scale technology being applied to the fish, you know, being able to literally catch the last one. And the only exception for that, thankfully, for Maine has been lobster, which has had an opposite trend.
That's really interesting because, as you say, we've seen this the damage that's been caused by overfishing to the fin fish, those things like the cod that used to be. There would have been a time when people could hardly have imagined that you could exhaust that supply, but it's happened, and other fish as well, and same kind of things have happened on the European side of the Atlantic. But with the case of lobster, it's different, and it continues to be an important source of income for people there in Maine, and it seems to have something to do with the fact that there was a more conscious effort to preserve and to use the resource more carefully so that it wouldn't be exhausted.
Yeah, the lobster is sort of an exception in the world's fisheries. I mean, fisheries are collapsing absolutely everywhere and has become a major crisis for governments around the world. But the lobster fishery, strangely enough, has dodged a lot of that. You know, in most fisheries, you have what people have come to call a tragedy of the commons. You know, if you have all these better and better vessels and you're actually starting to wipe out the fish resource, you know, nobody owns the ocean, and therefore, you know, each individual fisherman doesn't really have an incentive not to catch the last fish, because if he doesn't, somebody else will, and you've all got mortgage payments. And so everyone's sort of in a race to the bottom to catch the last fish. Well, the Maine lobster fishery, well, on paper, no one owns the sea. In reality, in Maine, sort of an outgrowth of Maine culture, the sea actually is owned in a sense. I mean, each individual little outport and harbor in mid-coast and eastern Maine actually controls its own piece of the bottom of the ocean, which they call their lobster bottom. And they have their own turf or territory, and they defend it from lobstermen from other harbors and largely determine, you know, who is allowed within the community to fish in that area. It's sort of like a communally held pasture. And because of that, and because it developed that way, the fishery has managed to avoid becoming a large-scale industrial fishery. It's still fished by guys who go out in boats that they own themselves with maybe one or two, you know, assistants, and they, you know, go out and trap things with snares and come back to the same port at the end of the day or even in the middle of the afternoon. It's sort of an anachronism in today's fisheries world, but they're able to control who ends up fishing in there and by what means. And because they depend on this pasture, you know, if it collapses, everyone's in trouble. The lobstermen themselves have enforced Maine's conservation laws, which are fortunately excellent and prohibit the taking of very small lobsters and very large lobsters. And when somebody catches a female lobster who's carrying eggs, they should look like caviar on the bottom of the tail of the lobster. Rather than keep that lobster, they'll actually clip a little notch in its tail to mark it and throw it back. Mm-hmm. And in future, after the eggs are laid and somebody else catches the lobster, and there's no more eggs on it, they'll still clip notice the clip in the tail, reinforce the clipping in the tail so when the lobster sheds, it's still there, and throw it back so that the successful female breeders are never caught in theory. And there may be a very large stock of enormous female lobsters down there who are contributing to the success of the fishery. It's sort of a triumph of the commons, if you will.
Yeah. We have a couple of additional callers. So let's get back to them, and we'll have somebody here in Indiana, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, two questions. One may be too nebulous, but I was concerned wondering about the cost of living in Maine. I'm retired now and been considering Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, and I wonder if you could give, you know, sort of travel log or something like that. And secondly, why haven't the big companies come in there and taken over? Sounds odd to me.
On the first question, the cost of living in Maine is sort of notoriously high. I mean, people generally don't have a lot of money here, but you know, the winter is long and the climate is ferocious, and we're sort of, you know, off in a sort of the wrong direction from the rest of the country, so it tends to be that things imported into Maine cost a little bit more than they would in other parts of the East Coast, and we're taxed fairly high. Despite that, because the coast is so beautiful, I mean, large numbers of people have come here to retire, but, you know, it does cost more to live here, and in general, if you actually are not retired and coming for a job, you know, there are fewer jobs, and the sort of the difference between the cost of living and typical wages is enormous here. It's one of the biggest gaps in the country. I'm sorry, and on your other question on the, yes, that's right, on the lobster fishery, I mean, because these harbors, each harbor kind of controls its local turf, and because it's a trap fishery, it hasn't been possible for, you know, say a large capitalist to invest in industrial scale boats and come in and fish the area because, you know, if you're not welcome in a lobstering turf and you go lay out all your lobster traps, whoever you are, and, you know, you don't really have permission from the community sort of to do it, then, you know, the next foggy day, they'll have what's called a killer fog, and lo and behold, all your traps are missing because, you know, it's no way to guard against it at night or in the fog. And so if you don't have the acceptance of the community, your gear will just disappear, and it costs a great deal. You can lay out some more, but you have to leave it a day or two before you can tend it again. And if it keeps vanishing, for practical purposes, you can't really fish there. And I think that sort of stubborn hold that communities have had on what they view as a communal resource has kept the fishery small and sort of, you know, individual, almost like a cottage industry. But fortunately, that's also appears to have been, it's allowed it to develop at a scale that the lobster themselves can endure. And despite the fact that, you know, as all these other fisheries have collapsed and more people fishermen have turned to lobstering to survive because the other fish resources are gone and more people are lobstering, over the past 20 to 30 years, the catch has just kept going up. And the best, you know, it's actually tripled in the past 20 to 30 years over the historic norm. And despite that, it appears that there are plenty of baby lobsters. There actually seem to be more lobsters than there ever were in the past. So it appears to be a fishery that works.
All right. Let's talk with someone here on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question regarding the price of lobsters. When you go to a restaurant, lobsters are one of the more expensive items you can possibly get. In fact, I think they cost more than a fillet. And I'm wondering, is the price high because the number of lobsters being harvested is low, or is what's the connection? What's the effect? And to follow up on that, I know someone who's a waitress, and she says in many, many restaurants, what they serve and claim as lobster is actually, I'm not sure what it was, a South African rock, something which is in that family, but in fact is not a lobster, and it costs less for the restaurant to buy, and therefore they make a profit, but people don't realize they're not getting lobster. So can you talk about those two things?
On the first question, I mean, oddly enough, yes, the lobster prices are actually at an all-time high, slightly more than they have been in recent years. And that's despite the fact that we've been catching record numbers of lobsters in both Maine and Nova Scotia, which sort of dominate the world's lobster landings. And the reason for that is actually that there's more and more demand for lobsters, and that mostly appears to have been driven by improvements in shipping technology. I mean, Federal Express, you know, has a special lobster shipping container that lobster wholesales can can dispatch lobsters, you know, immediately, you know, absolutely have to get there overnight, straight to, you know, Tokyo or Hong Kong or wherever. And suddenly, live lobsters can be shipped to a global market. And recently, there's also been a new technology. It used to be in the past, the reason that you tend to get your lobsters live and cook them live is lobsters start putrefying almost immediately after they die. And there was never in the past a way to freeze them or keep them other than keeping them alive. So that sort of limited how far afield you could successfully ship lobster or competitively ship lobster. Well, now there's a new high-tech freezing method that seems to create a very good product. So they're actually able to freeze lobsters in great numbers and ship them, you know, as far as you want without such worries about time. So that's basically meant that more and more parts of the world have access to lobster, which has just kept ramping up the demand. So I think the lobster prices continues to go up for that reason. And I'm sorry, the other question was?
That I've been told that in many
restaurants,
getting real lobster, you're getting something like a
cousin. Right, that other species are perhaps being used.
Yeah.
Here in Maine, there's actually, you know, in the past, there were actually laws prohibiting any other kind of, even Louisiana crawfish and French, you know, versions of lobster and Caribbean lobster from even being imported into the state to basically defend Maine lobster. That was later struck down as being, you know, unconstitutional barrier to trade. But in Maine, it would be difficult to foist another kind of lobster on anyone. But yes, once you get, you know, into the Midwest where people aren't, you know, as familiar on a day-to-day basis with lobster, I wouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, one of the things that isn't really illegal to say is that, you know, we're giving you lobster tails, but they're not mentioning that it's the Caribbean spiny lobster, which you may be getting, which is caught in Belize and southern waters and looks a little bit like a lobster but has great big antenna and no claws at all. And there may be other species that people are able to serve as lobster, legally speaking, that aren't Maine lobster. Best way to know for sure is to have it in the shell.
I think Maine has done an incredibly good job, both the industry and the government, in controlling the quality. And just say this in contrast to Georgia, which is the home of the Vidalia onion. And, of course, Vidalia onions became very, very popular. And there was a chemist who came out with a chemical test to determine the sweetness of an onion. And he wanted to use it so that people could say, we're real Vidalia onions. You know, we're not just onions grown in Georgia. And the state legislature of Georgia passed a law that it was illegal for that test to be used. And so they basically, people who eat Vidalia onions will realize now they're nowhere like they used to be, but lobsters sure are.
Maine's had sort of the opposite experience where our sort of marketing and promotion of the Maine lobster and the words Maine and lobster going together has been so effective that, you know, an equally large amount of the United States lobster supply actually comes from Nova Scotia, which shares the Gulf of Maine with us and has similar history and topography and such. But, you know, almost all those lobsters are sold as Maine lobsters because the two words go together much better than Nova Scotia lobsters in most consumers' minds. So we've sort of taken over the patch from other provinces.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. The whole lobster story is pretty interesting when you consider nowadays it is thought to be a great delicacy, and there are people who are willing to pay a lot of money for them. I think that's also part of the reason they're so expensive is that people are willing to pay the money. And when you look at, though, the lobster's history, there was a time when you could hardly not give them away. And I think, do I remember in the story there was something about how they used to feed it to prisoners, and there was virtually a riot. And the prisoners say, you're giving us too much lobster, and finally got the concession that they would be served lobster no more than three times a week. Now we think it's this wonderful great treat and people will pay whatever they're asked for it.
Yeah, it's true. The for all the way up until, you know, the 1860s or so, for the first 150 years, you know, of settlement here, you know, you couldn't give lobster away. They were everywhere. You could send your kid out to you know, walk around wading, you know, in ankle deep water, and you could, you know, gaff and gather, you know, 2, 3, 4 pound lobsters, as many as you want. But because as I said, the lobster starts spoiling as soon as it dies, and there was no refrigeration and not any good roads or anything. You couldn't, bring it anywhere to sell it before it died and was no good anymore. And you couldn't sell it to your neighbors, really, because they could send, their kids out and gather as much as they want. So it's sort of a food of last resort. And there was so much of it that in storms, a heavy storm, there were so many lobsters in shallow water that they'd be thrown up, and killed on land and be kind of have them scattered on the top of the beach, and people would collect them in wheelbarrows and fertilize their gardens with them. So it went from sort of a cheap fertilizer to the luxury it is today, only at the time when people figured out ways where you could transport them. Hmm. And strangely enough, it was Boston and New York in the second part of the 19th century, people started getting a taste for lobsters, and they quickly caught most of the lobsters in their area because it's not very good lobster habitat in those parts of the country. And they started going further and further afield for lobster, but the lobster would start spoiling, if they tried to bring them from Maine. And, leave it to Yankee ingenuity, somebody scratched their head and figured, why don't I drill a whole mess of holes in the side of my boat and flood one of my holds with seawater and put all the lobsters in there, and then the seawater will circulate and keep them alive. And it worked, and a new kind of vessel called the lobster smack was born. You were able to keep them alive. But the first owners of these smacks, when they got to Maine, wanted to load up with lobsters, had to talk Maine fishermen into fishing for the lobsters. The Mainers were in absolute disbelief that anybody actually wanted to buy them, and many of the early smack boat captains, had to, give them the traps and, beg them and give them special offers to go out and actually catch these things for them. So the fishery was sort of imposed from the outside because of demand in the outside.
Let's go on, and we got some other folks here. Homer, caller here, line number one. Hello.
Yes. Well, I guess I understood from the beginning you're talking about Maine in general, and as much as I enjoyed the lobsters and the coastal Maine, it's actually been 20 years since the first time I was up in the North Maine woods, and unfortunately I haven't been back in 15 years in the Allegash waterway. And that was one of my favorite spots in the country for what the state did in conjunction with the private landholders to preserve a wonderful wild river.
Yeah, the book is actually about cultural history of the coast of Maine, but I also grew up in the interior. I have family ties to the coast and now live on the coast. But
I missed the beginning of the show.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right. The interior of Maine, if you look on a map, you'll notice that despite the fact we're on the east coast near the major population centers of the country, you look at the map and there's a whole third of the northern part of the state that not only don't have any towns marked on it, there aren't any roads marked on the map. It's a giant forest frontier that was used historically by the paper companies as sort of a vast source of pulp for mills. And because of that, nowadays the paper companies are actually leaving Maine because of in globalization, I guess there are less expensive ways and places to harvest trees, and they're divesting themselves of these huge holdings of land in Maine. And places like the Allegash you described, which is, for those who don't know, is a wilderness river that goes on for, 100 miles or so through complete, wilderness forests. There's been efforts in the state. One of the big arguments is, what should be done with the Great North Woods? What should the future be? And should there be a national park there or conservation land or, should people be allowed to buy it up? And so it's been one of the sort of contentious things, the sort of future of the Maine woods.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful book, and I think I'll put it on the list of things to read. But I'll mention that, Maine is one of those places that has vacation land on the license plate. And I'd almost rather it not be advertised except for, everybody can go to Florida or California. But
we get feeling the same way here sometimes,
yeah.
Because, our towns are so overwhelmed for about 2 months of the year and then completely shut down. It can be kind of a shock when the great, wave of tourists arrives.
Well, it's a wonderful place, and I'm glad the people of Maine share it with the rest of us.
Right. Well, thank
and
you
keep
for the
it
call.
That way.
All right. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Maybe I should introduce again our guest, Colin Woodard. He's a journalist who specializes in global affairs. He's contributed to Christian Science Monitor, San Francisco Chronicle, Chronicle of Higher Education. He's reported on more than 40 countries from around the world. He was born and raised in Maine and now makes his home in Portland, and he is the author of a book that looks at some of the history of the coast, the Maine coast. The title of the book is The Lobster Coast, Rebels, Rusticators, and the Struggle for a Forgotten Frontier, and it's published by Viking. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Another cell phone caller is next, and this is line two. Hello.
Hi. Another one of the exports of Maine and Portland are DeLorme maps. And their first state atlas was for Maine, and it emphasizes outdoor access for hunters and fishers, and I don't know whether it has campgrounds or not, but the maps are incredibly detailed, and if people, I've mentioned them before on other times I've called in, but if you think about a standard U.S. road atlas, these are the same size, but they are for individual states, and they now have them for every state, and they now have topography added, and U.S., you know, the, what do you call it? The stuff you can use with the satellites. The word's not coming to my mind. Anyway, and I would recommend to the person looking for the little town that his family may have come from that he just go and get a DeLorme map. They're available in lots of bookstores, and they're very noticeable because they have a big red triangle down one corner. One of the things that I remember from vacationing in Maine when I was a child, and my family would go up there from New Jersey. Interestingly, they started doing that because an uncle was sent to go up there for his health. He had some sort of lung disease. But we didn't do a whole lot when we were up there. We just basically hung out and watched, and we stayed above the garage of a family who had a huge parcel of land on the coast, and we would just watch the tides and play in the rocks, and it was just lovely. It's hard to hear you because I think we're trying to both talk at the same time.
We were just listening to you. We weren't talking.
Okay. I'm done.
Okay. Well, Colin, is there anything you want to comment on there?
The DeLorme people will be thrilled with the pitch for the gazetteers and atlases. They are in fact excellent. They're topographical. You know, if you want to know how to hike over, you know, from this town to that by climbing over a mountain or something, on foot, they're the thing to have, and to find every little hamlet and corner and pond in the state, and they have expanded elsewhere. And yes, I mean, one of the wonderful things about Maine is a lot of the coast has remained relatively undeveloped, and, you know, people are able to come and enjoy, you know, coast and islands and solitude and sort of recharge their batteries. It's sort of that the Maine myth is still alive because there's truth to it. I mean, the East Coast is such a busy and highly built and, you know, stressful and manic place, and not so far from the big population centers is this, largely undeveloped, fairly wild, almost frontier sort of state and land. And that's one of the things that's attracted people to visit and indeed move and live here for generations.
The DeLorme maps, by the way, are also very useful even for states like Illinois, where it's so easy to find your way around. And we have them for all of the surrounding states, and it has encouraged us to take routes other than the interstate. And even when we're taking the interstate, we sometimes go off and make a shortcut through back roads because we can, and because when there's construction and so forth, it's very nice to have an alternative. You might also, if you feel like it, talk about L.L. Bean. Isn't that the store that doesn't have a key to its door and is open 24 hours a day?
That's true. I mean, I think when people from outside the Northeast, you know, think of Maine, I think three phrases come up. I think lobster, Stephen King, and L.L. Bean are the three things that people associate with Maine. It's a 24-hour, one of the first sort of 24-hour stores. It started as a sportsman store in Freeport and became sort of a pilgrimage spot. It's about 3 hours from Boston and sort of metropolitan Boston, and people would, felt like doing something in the middle of the night, would jump in their cars and
drive the 3 hours to Freeport and, you know, go shopping from 3 to 5 in the morning and drive back kind of thing. It's now expanded like so many things. You know, there's, you know, one in every mall in New England, it seems like now. But it was sort of a unusual oddity for a long time and a famous Maine company.
Well, I thank the caller for the call, and let's go on here. We have somebody next up in Oakwood. This is line 4. Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Good. I don't know if you touched on this earlier or not, but I think I remember reading in the Geographic months ago, they were talking about lobsters, and just as a curiosity note here, trivia, they said they were so plentiful back in the early colonial days that the indentured servants actually had it worked into their contracts that they would not be forced to eat lobster more than 3 days a week. And I thought that was kind of interesting to the way things are now.
It's true, and we did actually mention it earlier in the program and talk about it a bit. But yeah, the lobster has gone from being a hated food, and you know, even as late as the 1940s and 1930s. I mean, I talked to older people who, you know, remember the shame of going to school. You know, they grew up very poor and having to go to school and reveal to their friends that their mother had packed them a lunch of lobster rolls, because this was so shameful, the notion that the only thing you could eat was lobster, because many of the people in the town were lobstermen at the time, and it was an indication that you were woefully poor. And now, of course, lobster is the it's like caviar, you know, the Rolls Royce of seafoods.
All right. Well, I'm going down the dip now, so I'm probably going to lose you.
Have
a good day, y'all.
Thanks for the call. In the book, if people are interested in learning a little bit more about the early history of Maine, there's certainly a lot of that here. One of the things that I want to ask you about, when Europeans first came to the Maine coast, there were significant numbers of indigenous people who were living there, dozens of tribes apparently there were in this area, although there are only two left today. And as you, I think that you mentioned that there was a period, of warfare between the Native Americans and the Europeans. What's today in Maine? What's the kind of state of relations between European American Mainers and the indigenous people, the Native American Mainers?
Well, compared to the 1600s and the colonial period, the number of Wabanaki who remain is very, very small, just a shadow of what the population once was. Maine does have two legally recognized tribes, Passamaquoddies and the Mi'kmaqs, who each have, there was a landmark land settlement case where the tribes, like many tribes in the United States, they signed, treaties with the U.S. government, which the U.S. government then broke, seizing their lands illegally, and they had some claims which they won, which gave them a large settlement of land in Maine. Relations have been, I would say, relatively good, but both tribes are based in very, very remote parts of Maine, in the east and central interior. So a lot of people on the more populated parts of the southern midcoast probably rarely encounter Mi'kmaqs and Passamaquoddies, to their knowledge. There have been some very contentious issues recently, though, because the Indian tribes wished to build a enormous resort casino in southern Maine, using Maine's one of the states where you can't have casinos, but using sort of their prerogative as federally recognized sovereign peoples, they had a loophole they were trying to exercise to start a casino, which would have brought money and resources to the Indian tribes, but it was very contentious and ultimately rejected by the voters of Maine in a referendum, because a lot of people felt like a large resort casino was not sort of consistent with sort of Maine's values and stuff, and worries about runaway, crime issues and traffic and other things that have happened to other states where large-scale casinos have been built.
We are coming down to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes. I do have another caller here, someone over in Terre Haute, Indiana. So let's talk with them. Line 4. Hello.
Yes, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the history of the Bush family and the Walker family and Kennebunkport and mm-hmm. Walker's Point and all that. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, the Walker side of the Bush family, that would be George Sr.'s grandfather, purchased a point of land near Kennebunkport, which is on the southern part of the Maine coast, back in, I can't remember the exact date, 1907, 1908, something like that, and built a compound for his family. The family, the Walkers, were originally from the St. Louis area and would summer there, and the property has remained in the family hands ever since and has fallen to the Bush end. The George Sr. and Barbara Bush purchased, I believe, all of it or most of it outright from other heirs at some point along the way, and became the sort of preferred summer home of the Bush family during the first during Bush Sr.'s time as president. It was sort of contentious under for a couple of reasons. While Bush Sr. was president, he attempted to avoid Maine state taxes. He'd sort of spent, when he wasn't in D.C., he spent most of his time at his Kennebunkport residence, but he declared himself to be a resident of a hotel in Houston, Texas, where apparently he'd only spent a few days of the entire year. And so there was this big, high-profile controversy in Maine over, you know, whether or not he should be paying taxes to Maine or not. And then the city of, the town of Kennebunkport, which is a very small little coastal community, whenever George Sr. or George W. visit Kennebunkport, the town is, of course, absolutely paralyzed with not only people, you know, with sightseers wanting to come and see it, but with the security, you know, blockades and preparations and such required to protect Walker Point from potential attack. It sort of paralyzes the town, so Kennebunkport kind of has a siege mentality whenever the more prominent members of the family are at Walker Point.
We're coming down, unfortunately, we have just a couple of minutes left, and one of the things that you explain in the book is that if you looked at the coastal region, it's generally thought of as being kind of three, with southern Maine, where Portland is, perhaps being the most like Massachusetts and with the kind of development that's happened along the eastern seaboard, and then the most northerly part, and maybe the part that has changed least. Is there a lot of concern about sprawl and about Maine, and particularly coastal Maine, just becoming another extension of the development that we have seen on the east coast of the United States?
Oh, very much so. And well, I've said this book is a cultural history. I mean, it's looking very much at explaining what the coast is and the present issues affecting the coast by reaching back into the past to kind of, you know, build people's understanding of what the coast is and how it became the way it is. And most of the current challenges, which I go into in quite a bit of detail at the end of the book, that are facing Maine are sort of exactly those kind of development challenges of suburbanization and sprawl, you know, creeping up the coast very rapidly. And I've just, you know, described earlier, there's an enormous disconnect between the cost of living in Maine and the amount of money that Mainers actually can make locally. Well, as more and more people from other parts of the country have been drawn to Maine for retirement homes and have been buying, you know, and building large homes in recent years, you know, almost everywhere on the coast, it's created an incredible increase in real estate values, you know, like 500, 600, 700% in the past decade. And at the same time, there's, you know, not really any change in what Mainers actually can make if you have to make an income locally. And so it's caused a sort of displacement of, you know, many of people whose families have lived in towns for, you know, generations, sometimes centuries, being displaced, you know, because they can no longer afford not only to buy property in their hometown, but just to pay the property taxes on land that's been in the family for generations. And this is, you know, leading to sort of a fear of Maine losing both its cultural identity and losing its sense of place. You know, that the sort of qualities and things that drew people to visit Maine in the first place might be lost, that Maine will just become another kind of anywhere, you know, sprawl part of the East Coast. Mm. And that's something that, you know, I think very few people who know Maine want to see happen, and has become a central issue that that we in the state are, you know, dealing with in one form or another all the time these days.
Well, we'll have to leave it there because we've come to the end of the time. I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Our guest, Colin Woodard, and if you'd like to read the book, it's titled The Lobster Coast, Rebels, Rusticators, and the Struggle for a Forgotten Frontier. That's the subtitle. The book is published by Viking.